Kakao.
Aha. Bienvenidos a la cita del amor. Alright. No, this is not the dating game in Espanol. It's just a phrase I memorized from 10th grade Spanish. This is the 70s Big Podcast, and I'm your host, Justin. I don't have any guests today, and instead, I'm going to go through some questions that were asked on the Facebook fan page, the 70s Big Facebook fan page. I asked people to comment and ask some questions, and they did so. Some of them are good, some of them are terrible, but that's how it works with 70s Big. And we're going to answer some questions, and we might have some special guests later. And, of course, you can write in, you can give suggestions to the podcast. I'll probably ignore them, as I usually do, but you can always make requests, and we can even do some special segments. So feel free to write on the wall of the Facebook fan page or write in the comments of this podcast's post on the website. All right, first question. The first question that was asked on the thread is from John H. And he says, how applicable is the 70s Big Method to general health and fitness, a.k.a. the average American Jane Joe? I don't think I've met anyone named Jane. I know a few people named Joe. It's neither here nor there, but I don't know what the 70s Big Method is. I guess when people come to the site, they interpret that as eating a lot and probably lifting, and I would assume they mean not conditioning at all. I would assume that's what they think because of what they see when they first get to the site. And let me make it clear, and I've made this clear in the past, but when you need to gain weight, you need to eat in order to gain weight. And I just don't mean gain weight for the sake of gaining weight. I mean gaining muscle mass. And fat is associated with muscle gaining because when you eat a surplus of calories, there might be a little bit of fat on there. But as has been pointed out on the internet plenty of times in someone's linear progression when they are actually skinny, majority of what they gain is muscle. And you can gain slower but cleaner with less body fat, but if you're gaining a lot of body fat, that's your fault. And you can adjust your body fat to change that. I'm going to update the nutrition section to kind of reflect that. We're definitely going to keep the old section. But if you actually look at the old section, it's about 12 pictures of meat that Gant put up. And so anyway, the 70s Big Method just means being strong and bigger and more muscular because you're strong, and it includes health and being conditioned. I mean, I don't want anyone to be fat, and I don't want anyone to not be able to perform in whatever it is they want to do, whether that's chasing their kids or riding a mountain bike. I mean, whatever. So there is no 70s Big Method. If anything, it just means being strong and attacking your goals with fervor. So thanks, John F. or John H. for the first question on the podcast. Jason, excuse me, K. asks, what is your opinion of high bar back squats for those who have shoulder or elbow problems from low bar back squats? I'm going to interpret this in two different ways. The first way is that you're just unflexible or inflexible to do the low bar back squat because of anterior shoulder tightness. And in that case, a person shouldn't do the low bar back squat, A, because if they can't get in a good position, then it's not really going to work anyway, and B, if it's painful, then they shouldn't do it anyway. So the high bar back squat is a good substitute, even though there's a little bit of musculature change in what is actually being involved. But if someone has to high bar because they don't have the mobility in order to low bar, that's fine. But he seems to be asking about problems from the low bar, and in that case, there's definitely something wrong with the grip and how the bar's sitting on the back if you're getting pain in your elbow or shoulders from the low bar. It could be that your shoulders aren't very flexible enough to do that position, and in which case you'd have to work on your internal rotation mobility, working on your anterior shoulder girdle in order to loosen that up. But usually when people have issues in their elbows and even a little bit of shoulder in the low bar back squat, it's because the grip is wrong. And the grip might be pushing in their hand, which pushes down the elbow, which can put a lot of stress on the medial aspect of the elbow, and even reverberating back up and kind of like straining the anterior portion of the shoulder. So it's definitely a grip thing. and grip is dependent on the person, because you can have short arms, long arms, you can have broad shoulders, narrow shoulders. So I can't really answer it over a podcast, but if you have problems as a result of the low bar, then you're doing it wrong. And I would wonder how many people, if they actually read the book, would have shoulder problems. I do know that when I first started doing it, my shoulders had a little bit of pain, but then after doing it, correctly and working on my shoulders in the first couple months, this is before I went to Texas, then I was able to do it fine, especially by the time I got to Texas. And I remember Rip watched my first set, and he's like, "Well, I guess the book can't fuck it up too bad," or something like that. So I wonder how many people that have these problems have actually, read that portion of the book and actually implemented it correctly. The next question is from Kyle M., and I have some experience with this fella. He asks, "Has anyone really been far, even as decided to use, even go want to do, look more like?" It's a good question, and I really don't have an answer. So let's scrolling down the thread here. Craig K. asks, "What are your thoughts on powerlifting as an Olympic sport? Would this take away from weightlifting? Is it even possible?" I guess I'll answer the last one. Yeah, it's possible. What are my thoughts, though? I don't really give a shit. I'm apathetic to the whole thing. I'm apathetic to a lot of things. I know that the IPF is trying to get to the point where the IOC will pull them into and have their sport be included in the Olympics. I think Glenn Penley told me that this is probably not going to happen because there's already lifting in the Olympics, and it really, at least in our country, it's not that popular, and it's probably one of the lesser or the least popular sports in the Olympics. I don't know. I'm just pulling stuff out of my ass. Again, I don't care. So do I think powerlifting is going to become an Olympic sport? No. If it does, it's not going to be for a while. And it's possible, but I don't really care. Let's see. Scrolling down the list. Let me check to see if this is still recording. Good. Jeffrey V. Jr. says, "I want to get 70s big but lose the gut? Question mark." That's not a question, Jeffrey. That's a horrible question, because it's not a question. It's a statement with a question mark at the end. Just because you put a question mark doesn't make it a question. But let's say that he wants to get bigger, but he doesn't want to have a gut. And I don't know if he has a gut. I'm just looking at his thumbnail. He's got a girlfriend, so shouldn't have to worry too bad. But if you want to lose body fat, then you have to make a change that's going to help you lose body fat. So you're going to have to, your program and your eating and all of that kind of stuff, how you train is and eat are going to have to reflect the fact that you want to lose body fat. So it's possible to lose body fat, and it's not terribly difficult. It's actually probably more difficult to gain muscle than it is to lose body fat, but it requires eating a certain way. And people that don't have a lot of body fat may have it better or easier genetically, and maybe because of their training history, but they make decisions that help them have low body fat for the most part. Let's not take the freaks into consideration that just are going to always have low body fat, but you have to do something like cleaning up the diet in order to have lower body fat. And personally, I see a nice little correlation with high intensity exercise in my body fat. But I've always had I've been training since I was like 14, doing some kind of lifting since I was 14, so I've always had more muscle mass than normal, and that obviously helps metabolism. So the more muscle mass you have and the less body fat you have, then it's easier to tweak. And the good news is, once you get there, it's easy to make it go up or down, the lower body fat you have. So maybe not into like under 10%. I'm just talking about if you have fluffed up 5 pounds, that it's easier to bring it back down 5 pounds of body fat or so. I'm just speaking conceptual, so don't take it literally, for God's sakes. Scott F. asks, "Are back squats still the king of exercises? Why or why not?" Back squats are definitely the king of all exercises, and that's due to the fact that you have a load supported on your back, so your entire body is being involved in supporting that load, including all of the trunk muscles, albeit isometrically. But you take the hips and the knees, which are the two areas of the body, specifically the hips, that are going to apply force into the ground or water, in order to do something athletically. And you lower the weight, and you go through a full range of motion to the extent that the hips and knees can flex, and then you extend both of them. And when you do that correctly, you train all of that musculature to extend those joints. And those joints, again, are the primary things that affect athletic performance. So the stretch reflex is a huge difference over something like the deadlift. And the deadlift obviously doesn't take the knees through a full range of motion, so that's a limiting factor in it being a king of exercises. I'd consider it the queen, but the squat is the king because of the stretch reflex and the full range of motion. Going down, having a stretch reflex, going up. Stretch reflex is a big part of athletic performance, whether it's jumping or even some agility. And squatting itself doesn't make you agile. It doesn't make you powerful to an extent. Yet it gives you the fundamental capacity or the foundation in order to apply into other activities. You have to get conditioned with your strength, and that's why the field is called strength and conditioning. This shouldn't come as a shock. I mean, it's been called that for quite a while. And I wrote about this in the Texas Method ebook. Conditioning is two things. The first thing is, of course, getting your physiology adapted so that you can consume and deliver substrates so that they can provide the energy in order to maintain a metabolic output in a given amount of time. So that's one aspect of conditioning. The second is structural, in, you know, adapting your structures, whether that's bones, ligaments that hold the bones together, muscles, or tendons that hold the muscles to the bones. Getting those structures adapted to something that they're not adapted to. And that makes sense, because if you are going to just try running hill sprints when you haven't even ran at all or even done a slow run, then that's silly, and it shouldn't be a surprise why you might pull your hamstring or your calf in doing something like that. So you have to use strength and then ease into a new activity. Easing into it by introducing it, crawl, walk, run. That's how any exercise should be done, whether you're starting RDLs for the first time or you're trying to get back into running. Because there's no, especially if you're young, in your 20s, there's no reason that your structures can't adapt to that activity unless you have existing knee pathology or injuries. If you've done very linear type lifting and you've only, you know, squatted and deadlifted and maybe cleaned and snatched, and your body has only gone through the impact of snatching and cleaning other than the squatting and the deadlifting, and then it hurts when you do anything other than those things like running, that doesn't mean your knees can't adapt to running again, or, you know, racquetball or basketball or whatever. It's just that at that time you haven't done that kind of stuff and your knees are adapted to the slower, you know, the lifting related stuff. So you have to ease into that other stuff. And that happened with me when I was weightlifting more so, and wasn't really conditioning, is that my knees hurt. I think I chased my dog once and my knees were slightly sore, not to the point where it was crippling or anything, but I adapted them over time. And, you know, obviously they don't hurt now because I've conditioned my structures in order to do other things other than lifting. And I think that's important, and that's part of what GPP is, like general physical preparedness. So the king of all exercise question kind of took a turn there, but strength and conditioning is important, and conditioning consists of conditioning the structures as well as the physiology as far as energy consumption, delivery. And yes, back squats are still the king of all exercises. Kyle S. asks, how should a trainee deal with stalling on a linear progression in one lift significantly sooner than the others? Or does this happening indicate something incorrect in training? It would indicate something incorrect, and usually that's a technical error, because we have to assume that you're doing something mechanically incorrect, and that's what's preventing your lift from progressing properly. It's kind of a vague question, so I can't really answer it, and if Kyle has a specific question, then he can ask it. But generally speaking, if you're doing something incorrect, like if you're going down in the squat and your hips go forward, causing your knees to go forward, or your knees go in at the bottom and you're incapable of keeping your knees out with the external rotation of your hips, or in the press, the bar is, you're pushing it away from your face and it's looping around your face instead of keeping it nice and close. And so in those cases, if there's a mechanical disadvantage that's preventing you from doing the lift correctly, then that's something that's going to blunt progress in a given lift. So definitely if you are doing something like that, then it's going to hamper progress, and I can't know that unless I see it. I can usually catch it in videos and, of course, in person, but Kyle, if you have a specific question, go ahead and ask it. But usually when there's a stall on one lift over another, it's a result of something like that. Now, let's say that the mechanical advantages are correct and you're doing things right technically, and your form is good, then it just depends on the situation. So there's too many questions I'd have to ask in response, and let's move on. Jonathan C. writes, how did you meet Brent? I met Brent, I don't remember the first time I actually shook his hand or whatever, but I remember the first time I saw him. I was going to visit Texas to meet Rip and, you know, see if he would want me to come to his gym. And so I was visiting for 3 days in January of 2009, and I remember I got there, supposed to meet Rip at 1, I got there, and nobody seemed to be there, and there was one white car in the parking lot. And I'm sitting there, and I'm eating some food, and Brent walks out, didn't know who he was at the time, and he's got this fro. And it's not like a nice, even fro like you would think of like an afro. It's just this weird, frizzy Asian thing where it comes out like 15 inches on the right side and like 8 inches on the left side. And like he just got up and started training. He woke up, just walked in the gym. And he's going to his car, and I was thinking, man, he must be a real weightlifter. Because, you know, I was naive, like, oh, this is the Wichita Falls Athletic Club. And, you know, it's kind of talked up on the internet and stuff. So it was just funny because I saw Brent. He was the only one there. And I was like, he must be a real weightlifter. And he just turned out to be a real belligerent weightlifter. And actually, back then, he was pretty quiet. He didn't really talk a whole lot. And it wasn't until later that he got more belligerent after hanging out with us more. So it's either I'm either the reason he did, or it's my fault. I haven't decided which one yet. Eli W. asks, does body fat percentage matter when having a 70s big mentality? I'd say that 70s big mentality is more of an attitude in how you attack training. It's, you know, we talk about training hard and stuff, and I'd say that's the 70s big mentality, like going after your goals with fervor. And so that's the mentality. The mentality is a mindset, not how you look and stuff. But as far as like looking 70s big, then yeah, body fat does matter, because Doug Young and Pizarenko are not big fat guys. They're muscular. They're impressive specimens aesthetically as well as what they're capable of. And so, I mean, if you want to have lower body fat and be strong, that's whatever you want to do. I mean, I don't really care what Eli does or what anybody really does. It's just what they want to do. So whatever they want to do, I'll help them get there, because I don't want to be fat and be just a big tub of shit. And I wrote about that the other day, and it pissed a lot of people off. You know, I don't really care that I pissed a lot of people off, but personally, I'm not going to be impressed with a lifter. You know, we can talk about the world-class lifters who are lifting the heaviest weight, but I appreciate when someone is also, you know, just muscular looking, because everyone appreciates muscularity. Any guy does, and most women do to an extent. So, yeah, body fat matters, but it's relative to whatever you want, Eli or whoever. So, let's see. Matt W. says, I'm seriously considering ending my first raw powerlifting meet, but my bench is terrible. Especially if I try to pause, how do I know if I'm pausing long enough, and how should I pick my attempts come meet time? Okay, here's the length of time that you'll probably have to pause. Most federations, you're going to get the bar unracked, and you have to wait for a down command. They'll say, start, and then you lower the bar under control. And then depending on how controlled you are, that's how long your press command is going to take. So if you're under control and you touch your chest, this might be it. Touch chest, press, and then you lock it out, and then it's rack. So that length of time, touch chest, press, and it all depends on how you lower it, and then it also depends on the judge. So I have had some of my friends pause for this length of time. Touch chest, start, or press. So in other words, that's like a three count in my head. That doesn't mean you should train three counts all the time, especially with your heavier stuff, but getting used to a longer pause than you would ever experience in a meet is important. And if your bench sucks, then you have to improve your programming to improve the bench. So pausing and then the bench sucking are two different things. So pausing is like a skill that you use with your bench strength. It's kind of like conditioning it for a paused lift when you have strength. So let's go to the next question. Matt B. If you weigh less than 200 pounds, you cannot turn down food ever. Discuss. It just depends on what the person wants. I don't really think that any guy, regardless of height, should be less than, definitely not less than 150, but probably, you know, 170, 175. I do have a friend that's 5'4", and he's about 150, and he can do dips with four plates, and he can bench 300, and he kind of comes from more of like a benching a lot type of program, and so his squat and his deadlift aren't terribly impressive. They're in the, you know, low to mid 300s, but they'll go up over time, because he only wants to get stronger and bigger. So I would assume he'd probably get to 160, 165 and be, you know, squatting and pulling in the fours. But in his case, my point is that he shouldn't be trying to bust his ass to get to 200 pounds because it's not going to fit his frame. Like, I see his frame and it's not, like, 185 might be his top weight if he wants to be that heavy, but he'd be fucking jacked and, you know, kind of like Franco Colombo or something. Where it would, he would just be swollen on his joints, you know, like his forearms would just be ballooned over his wrists. So, it just depends on the person. If you're 6 foot and below 200 pounds, I think that's a problem, regardless of what your sport is, and barring some extreme circumstances. But so I don't really think that every, I don't care is the first thing, and then secondly, I don't think that anybody who's not 200 pounds needs to be 200 pounds, because obviously if you're fat and 200 pounds, then that's not as good as if you're muscular and 200 pounds. So take that into consideration. Jason K. was supposed to ask a question, and he just says, importance of facial hair, period. So facial hair is pretty sweet. Not everybody can grow it because of their job, but it definitely helps. Alrighty, Kyle M comments on the thread again, and he says, you've got to be kidding me. I've been further even more decided to use even go need to do look more as anyone can. Can you really be far even as decided half as much to use go wish for that? My guess is that when one really being far even as decided wants to use even go want, it is then that he has really been far even as decided to use even go want to do look more like. It's just common sense. I'd have to agree with him in this case. Alrighty. Wesley W. asks, what are some good ancillary grip strength exercises? How frequently should they be done? I'm not really a grip guy. Some people have asked me to do some grip posts. I should probably go and ask someone who knows more about it than me. The standard stuff is that just not using straps helps build your grip, but you don't want your grip to limit your back or your posterior chain training. You could try just, you know, holding your locked out deadlifts on the last set or your heavy deadlifts for as long as you can. That's something that Konstantinovs definitely does, and he can, I've watched a video of him alternating grip, doing a rack pull essentially with 959, I think, and he did a triple, and then he held the top of the third one for like 10 seconds. That's pretty damn impressive. So I've seen Gant do some work with the gi. He plays judo, so he like had this strap that's like gi material. Not a strap, but a length of cloth, and he put it over a pull-up bar and did pull-ups on that. At Quest Athletics, a gym in Duluth, Georgia, they have ropes, different size ropes. They actually sell them at quest-athletics.com. And there's regular size ropes and then thick ropes, and you can drape those over a pull-up bar and do pull-ups with those, and I've done that before. So, obviously, there's the Captains of Crush from Iron Mind, and those are pretty cool. So, that's crushing grip. And as far as anything other than crushing and holding grip, like, I'm not experienced with grip stuff, so I'll try and see if I can find anybody that I can either talk to on a podcast or highlight in a post or interview or something. Let's see. Michael W. says, I was doing pull-ups last week when I got to 11. My head started pounding like never before. I thought I was having a stroke. Seriously. Now whenever I really push squats or pull-ups, I get a fierce headache. This has never happened in my training before. Should I be worried? That's never happened in my training, dude. If it's still happening, you posted that on June 2nd, so it's 14 days ago. If it's still happening, then I hope you've seen a doctor since then. But It's weird that it happened on pull-ups. I don't really have an explanation. When you do anything and you hold your breath, like your intra-abdominal and thoracic pressure goes up through the, Valsalva maneuver, and then that also increases the pressure in your blood vessels. But over time, they adapted that, and you weren't using extra load. And even if you were, that's not a lot on pull-ups. So I don't know what happened with you. The point is that if and the reason I included this question in the podcast is because if anything weird happens like this, then be careful and fucking go see a doctor if you think it's pertinent. In this case, it would be pertinent. Like, if it lasted for several days, that's something that he should go see, because if something was wrong and you took something from the site stupidly, like, oh, I'm gonna be reckless and then I'm gonna train when my head's pounding, that's stupid, and don't do that. Whenever in doubt, fucking see a doctor. That's the consensus of that. Let's see. Stefan L says, if you do not have the genes for facial hair, what is the second best way to display the 70s big spirit? Again, spirit would be associated with the attitude, and that'd be just hitting your training hard. And now, if you want to look the part, you just got to be fucking, like, establish your swallow trophy and wear tank tops in the summer and short shorts, and in the winter wear boots and jeans and flannel. That's how I do it. I'm not 70s big or anything, but I'm definitely wearing a tank top right now as I record this, and if it was cold out, I'd definitely be wearing flannel. I don't know if I'd have an undershirt on under that flannel. Who knows? I freestyle. So let's see. Someone asked about rollerblading higher in the thread. It was actually Brian S., my buddy who likes weightlifting, my internet buddy. And so Boney came on and he said, let the expert handle this. First things first, safety first. Always wear your proper rollerblading safety equipment. Second, plan your goals on what parts of rollerblading you would like to get better at. Third, take action. Practice makes perfect. Consistency is the key. A pair of short shorts helps too. Stay tuned for more blading info. Blading, tweeting, and slinging coin by Boney. That was his post. I commented after that and said, he has spoken. Sage rollerblading advice. Let's see. Rob F. asks, do you think great lifters are born or made? I would think that if you went up to any great lifter and said, hey, were you just like gifted with this ability? Have you not worked towards it? Then they'd probably get a little pissed. I would, because I've been training since I was 14, and I'm not by any means strong, especially compared to the strongest guys in history or anything, but I'm stronger than an average person, and I didn't develop that shit from just sitting around and just accidentally getting it. Or I didn't develop the fact that I have more muscle and less body fat than an average person just by doing that. I fucking have trained and squatted every day, and I'm sorry, every week since I was about 14. Haven't gone many weeks without training. I've probably trained at least 2 times a week, almost every week since I was 14. And, most days when I was doing bodybuilding shit, that was 5 times a week, misguided training, but training or working out at least. And so, you have a genetic predisposition and you have to express that. The same way that if you have strength, you have to express that in conditioning. Just because you have a predisposition doesn't mean that you are just bam strong. Some people can walk up and deadlift 500 or 600 pounds, but those people aren't common. So great lifters definitely are made. Sometimes, they have help from their predisposition genetically, and then they express that in their phenotype through their training, or they enhance their predisposition through drugs or whatever. But even if they do that, they still have to work hard, and they still have to train hard, and they still have to put the time in and the work in. So regardless if you're steroided up or genetically gifted or not, you just have to train hard. And someone asked me about is it possible for them to genetically squat 400. I don't see why everybody can't squat 400. Not girls, but I mean guys. 400's not that much. It may seem pretty a big mountain for some people. For some of you guys, it may be in the 200s, but over time, let's say you're training for 5 years, there's no reason you shouldn't be squatting 400 eventually at some point in your life. And I would even go so far as to say maybe 500. If someone had a goal of squatting 500, maybe that's not their goal, but if someone was like, I want to squat 500, that's my primary goal. I read an IronMind article where a guy did that. He had a 400 squat and he was like, I want to squat 500. You know what he did later? And the picture had him wearing like basketball shoes, but you know, and had a back spot behind him and not any side spots, squatting 500. So I think that's definitely possible to squat 400 for anybody. So that's kind of related to the are you made or born kind of concept. Sean O asks, do you think it is more important to be strong or look good? And please don't give some limp dick response about how getting stronger equals looking better. Sean's my friend, and so that's why he's tolerated, I guess. Getting strong does make you look better, Sean, and if you had a posterior chain, then you'd fucking know that. Anyway, so Alan K asks, why are you going to Sydney instead of Melbourne? It's probably because Sydney's better. Yosh, who has been on the site for a while, yes, what's your stack? I don't really stack much. I have fish oil and my biceps. That's pretty much it. And my deltoids. That's my stack. Corey G, who I coached up in Chicago, he had a really funky-ass press and a funky-ass squat, and he thought his arms were too short when he had gorilla arms. Like, if anybody's arms are too short, it's me. I have the arms of a 5'3 girl in length, not size, of course. What are the main mistakes people make with the press, technique, and programming? Obviously, the technique is the bar path not being vertical, but Corey had this horrible-ass, like, overextension, his thoracic lumbar junction, so he was overextended, and his hips were anteriorly rotated, and I see that a lot. Even in guys, at the top of the press, their hips are anteriorly rotated, so lumbar sacral junction is overextended, and then thoracic lumbar junction is overextended as well, in some guys that can achieve this mobility. And that's not a stable position at the top. You want your trunk to be straight. And that's something I had to work with Corey on when I coached him. And we ironed it out pretty well. And, you know, he was doing something similar on his squat. And his squat was real funky looking. But we ironed it out because that's what I do. Carrie T. asks, what can we do to make the lifting community friendlier to women, both in the gym and online? Every week I have a post that says, women who train look great and, you know, they're squatting and deadlifting and it helps them get strong, blah, blah, blah. So, in other words, I think from my standpoint of having a website where there's like 98% of the readers are guys and they're from 22 to 30 years old and who are going to respond well to my weird-ass jokes and stuff, I think that the best I can do is try and resonate that message over and over that women can look, you know, look attractive and stuff and have basically have a great physique from lifting, and hopefully they can share that with their friends, whether they're friend, you know, acquaintances or their girlfriends or their wives and stuff. And that's how I'm approaching it. That's why I've tried to bring in more women to post about various things. And I think Ellie had a great post, I think in the second week of when they started posting on that Monday 70s Big Female thing, and she talked about her conversion from the cardio type training to the lifting type training. So I think that's the best way that I can do it. It's been one of my goals for I think well over a year and a half, and I actually since the site started, because there's that big misconception with lifting. So I'm doing the best that I can. Feel free to give suggestions, but I'll probably ignore them. What's the best way to get a pump for my traps, Bill K says. For your traps, probably power cleaning, but power shrugs obviously have a big use for trap work. Power shrugs in a rack. Scrolling down the thread here, getting towards the end. Mandy S. asks a pretty good question. Are unilateral leg exercises worthwhile? Things like Bulgarian split squats, reverse lunges, etc. If so, when and where and how to implement them in a program. I see utility in walking lunges, in side lunges, not necessarily even weighted in the side lunges case, or in the lunges, because just getting, it helps, it's like an active mobility work on the hip, especially if you stay at the bottom of a lateral lunge, like you're at the bottom of a squat, and your hips are externally rotating to reach out and move across the floor. So I think that, you know, that kind of stuff works really well. Walking lunges are better than doing a lunge and then pushing back up to your starting position. But as far as split squats, for the majority of people on the site, no, reverse lunges and split squats are going to be irrelevant. Perhaps using I think this was a Bulgarian thing, the step ups on a box where you're pretty much in like a deep squat with one leg and you step up and drive your heel through the ground with a bar on your back. So that may have some utility. I actually use that to try and rehab my hip. I use that for several workout sessions. So, but as far as Bulgarian split squats, reverse lunges, not really. And I would use them as assistants. Obviously, they're not going to be the primary focus of the workout, unless your focus of the workout is some kind of mobility element, which is definitely, you know, would be useful maybe in a as a light day or something, or just as a back off day or a deload week. So consider, take that in consideration with mobility and GPP and stuff. Christopher L., what do you think about running and sprints in addition to powerlifting, i.e. well on starting strength? Well, starting strength isn't powerlifting. Powerlifting is a specific sport that tries to put more weight on the bar. Strength training is just trying to get the muscles strong, and sometimes that doesn't always coincide with putting the most weight on the bar, but that's neither here nor there. But as far as running sprints, yeah, they're great. Obviously for conditioning, obviously for maintaining some physical preparedness in order to be able to run on a regular basis. You want to be careful if you're on starting strength. Starting strength has 3 squatting days. I don't really like stay confined in a linear progression. I usually adapt a linear progression based on the person. And a lot of people, I won't have squat 3 times a week, just because it can kind of, it'll back up too soon. And I want them to get the accumulated effect of squatting twice a week. So anyway, the running and the sprints, it's definitely useful, but you don't want it to interfere with your recovery. You don't want it to interfere with the actual strength portion. And so the program should reflect that. It's easy to program that stuff, and it depends on your goals. So I would need more data if I was going to answer that very specifically. Scrolling down. Win F asks, what's my Fran time? I did Fran in 2 minutes and 30 seconds when I actually did CrossFit. That was my second time doing it. The first time I did it in 4 minutes. Pretty irrelevant. Who cares? Shane D says, are weightlifters or powerlifters stronger? That's obviously dependent on what your definition of strong is and how you're going to test it. If you wanted to use a squat, then, of course, it depends on which two you're talking about. So that's kind of like a boring... That's like saying, what are your thoughts on abortion? It's just this thing that I'm so jaded on that I don't give a shit. And then Jeremy C., who is the strong dude from Canada, I think, was saying I should get someone to debate against me, but I don't care enough. Sorry, guys. I don't care enough to want to debate that issue. If you guys want to find someone that wants to debate a particular issue that I would care to debate about, then feel free to send them my way. Might be interesting. Scrolling down. Alrighty, last question here from Joe M. Can you talk about the transitioning, or rather he meant the transition from starting strength, novice, linear progression to grayscale linear progression, and when / how to progress beyond grayscale linear progression to Texas method or other methods? If you talked about this in your ebook, I apologize in advance. Coincidentally, I did talk about this in the ebook to answer this very topic. I didn't really talk about a trend in linear progressions because the book's not on linear progressions, and it would be a digression, is what we call it. But so in general, here's how I'd probably do it for, and of course, this is dependent on the person and what they want to do, but generally speaking, when someone's first starting to squat, they can squat 3 times a week and without much detriment. I might have them do that for a few weeks. I don't know, maybe even a month. And then I like the grayscale linear progression because it has 2 sessions of squatting and, 1 of deadlift. And I've done that, before the actual that book came out. And I did that with particular trainees, like maybe women or older trainees, and it works great because it has that one less day of squatting. And basically, we want, grayscale's designed, and the way it's different is that it has a little bit different rep scheme. Obviously, the last set goes to almost failure, and then, the fewer squatting days. And then it is designed to be elongated over a longer period of time to continue that progression. And the reason that's good is because you get the accumulated effect of doing the lifts You get the accumulated effect of squatting twice a week over a longer period of time instead of just kind of like bashing yourself with 3 times a week squatting. And 3 times a week squatting can be beneficial for, you know, a certain type of individual. For example, I went from 325 to 445 on my 3 sets of 5 in 8 weeks. And I gained about, I think, like 20 pounds. I went from 195 to 215 doing that. I was drinking a lot of milk and stuff. And so, you know, I put 120 pounds on my work sets in 8 weeks, and that's a good thing. I was 22 at the time, I think. So it's definitely useful for certain individuals, but my progression would not continue that long. And I was someone that didn't need a long linear progression. I was someone that wouldn't require the accumulated effect because I had decent musculature. You know, my legs had been... were not fitting into jeans since I was, 14. So I was someone that benefited, but more of a 2 times a week squatting would benefit other types of people. And usually it's just getting someone the accumulated effect of squatting and deadlifting consistently before they worry about anything more advanced. Because if someone hasn't done that, let's say for even half a year or even a year of just squatting twice a week and deadlifting once a week, that's very significant in how it'll affect their strength. Even if they go through an entire month in that 1 year of not even increasing the weight on the bar, it's going to be significant on their musculature. It's going to be significant on their metabolism. It's going to be significant of how they build a base of strength. And that's why it's useful to have something that elongates the progression. That's why the mentality of the grayscale is good instead of just hammering it hard. And so I like that. And it's applicable to a lot of people, especially a lot of you guys that just got into lifting as a result of seeing these sites or coming from a CrossFit background that doesn't have a lot of lifting in it. And so that's why it's useful. And then as far as shifting into a Texas method, it depends on what you're coming out of. But I talk about in the ebook that you are going to want to ease into like a volume day. And my volume days on the Texas method compared to a traditional Texas method are a lot lower, because you don't need as much volume. But, you know, initially for the first month or two, I'm going to have someone be close to 5x5s, but when they are easing into it the first few weeks, they're going to do ascending sets of 5, which is very different than doing sets across. And then they might get 4 weeks of doing the sets across, and then we might start ratcheting it back, because what I want is the volume to stay the same for several weeks. And the guideline I give in the book is keep it the same for 3 weeks as you push the intensity day for those 3 weeks, because I want that discrepancy to increase. So I'm getting a little off topic because I'm talking about the Texas method now instead of easing into it, but it's about keeping the volume ratcheted back and then improving the intensity. So I want to make that clear, because Texas method gets a bad rap because people don't use it correctly, and they try and push the volume and the intensity as if a 5x5 at 365 is good when you're only doing a top set of 5 at 385 or 405. You know, 405, that would only be a 40-pound discrepancy. That's not good. It's not good at all. Like, no one cares what you 5x5, and certainly the podium doesn't in a power meet. You're not going to win a medal for 5x5ing some impressive weight, and you're not going to have a good carryover into other activities if you're just 5x5ing. So your absolute strength is what's important, because that's going to be the thing that carries over into other activities and conditioning, whether it's learning how to do throws in judo properly or applying it into football or something. So you can check out the ebook as how to ease from a linear progression into a Texas method more specifically. And I'd kind of have a trend of people in a linear progression going from 3 days of squatting to 2 days of squatting. That'd be what I would typically have it do, just for a generic person that would have not had a training background, because I want them to get that accumulated effect of training, just like I talked about, for even 6 months to a year. It's going to benefit them more than them trying to jump in a 5-3-1 program when they haven't even really like established good baseline musculature. And so that's why when people are doing 5-3-1, they would usually benefit from something else, because the frequency is lower, and then the volume is lower. And volume doesn't have to be high, but volume does have to be existent to kind of get a response out of a non-drugged athlete. So especially one that's in the lower stages of their training career. Try not to say novice intermediate too much anymore, because people are really hardlining that. And, you know, Johnny Payne and I talked about that. It's just, you know, everyone's not in those nice little areas. There's a lot of gray area. It's a continuum. So if you're on the earlier, in the beginning stages of training, that little bit of volume, you know, like a 3x5 kind of thing, is going to benefit you. So I hope that helped your question, Joe M., and the rest of you that asked questions. I appreciate it because it gave some material for a podcast. And you can ask questions anytime on the Facebook fan page or in the comments, but it'll work better when you ask questions, they're actually in a thread that is designed to be directed at the podcast. So I'll have one of these threads up soon. You can put them in the comments of this post, and you can see that at 70sbig.com. It'll be in the week of June 16th where this podcast will be uploaded. And if you have any requests or any ideas, shoot them my way, because I'm here to fucking entertain, and I hope that you guys realize that. I'm here to help and entertain. Ever since I started the site in 2009, that's been my goal, is to help you guys, train well, program well, kind of teach you those things, kind of steer your training in the right direction if necessary, without any type of ingrained methodology. It's just kind of like a general thing, like how can you apply stress to get the response that you're looking for? And furthermore, what are like little tips along the way, maybe technique-wise or mental or things like that along the way, and I have to entertain you if you're going to read the damn site. So hopefully I'm accomplishing that, and you can always give feedback. So thank you for listening to the 70s Big Podcast, rated R.